Good morning. Today is Monday, January the 11th. Joining us this morning is Humboldt County District Attorney Stacy Eads. Good morning.
Good morning, Brian.
I've got a question, but it has nothing to do with drama or theater, if you're ready for it.
So ready.
Oh, it's a new category. Oh, politics and history. It's a new category. Either of those your long suit?
No.
Okay. Why are political positions referred to as left and right?
This feels like a really dangerous question. I have no idea what the actual answer would be, but, you know, obviously it seems that despite the fact that most of us have a lot of common ground, somehow we put people one extreme or the other. So I don't know.
Over 200 years ago, see, so it was safe. King Louis XVI of France was forced to convene a form of parliament for the first time in more than a century. At the assembly, the more radical delegates took up seats on the left of the king, while their conservative counterparts sat on his right. Ever since, liberal views have been referred to as from the left and conservative from the right.
Well, that makes sense.
Pretty darn insightful, if you ask me, right?
Perfect combination of history and politics. There you go.
Oh, boy. I'm starting to do a little research on some local history. It's intriguing some of the things that we have in the area. Why do we do these things? Why are these things located here? Those types of things. Do you spend any time going back into the history of what the office is? Or what it was? Or those types of things other than for cold cases?
Sometimes that happens just kind of by chance in the course of perhaps reviewing convictions, you know, and perhaps old murder cases where an issue's come up, or if there's a resentencing issue or something along those lines. So I have had the occasion to, you know, look, and that's just kind of interesting to be able to see old transcripts from back in the day, also reviewing convictions that might support a civil commitment. For example, what's coming to mind is with the sexually violent predators, looking back at the underlying investigation within those cases. So perhaps a sexual assault. And for me, that's really fascinating just to see how things have evolved over time in terms of how those investigations are undertaken and the technology and advancements that we have, as well as, I think, quite significantly, the newer approach in terms of having victim-centered interviews, appreciating that trauma has a direct impact on an individual's ability to communicate and relay what might have happened to them. Just looking at some of those interviews of the past and how perhaps the detectives, you know, might be in a room with a rape victim and asking very direct, sometimes seemingly accusatory questions. And we've really, in my view, come quite far in terms of how we handle those issues.
When you say older cases, mm-hmm. 10 years old or 100 years old?
Not 100 years old yet, but certainly 30, 40, 50.
Oh, okay. So recent history for some of us.
Sure.
Okay. The techniques that were used in investigations, obviously those have changed also simply through some of the judicial determinations over the years. Is there anything that's coming around the corner that's going to change how facts and information are gathered in the future?
There probably is. Nothing specific is really coming to mind in that regard. The, you know, as you indicated, things are always evolving and hopefully moving forward. And, you know, and I think just having a greater appreciation of every individual has their own unique life circumstances, and just trying to be as aware of those as possible, and collect the evidence that we need in the most, you know, human, compassionate manner that we can.
Different backgrounds, different stories, different experiences lead into a lot of different areas. But with the interpretation of that information that's gathered, is that often done by an individual or by a couple different folks, so that, you know, if somebody has experience in that area, they can weigh in on it rather than it being the first time for somebody to be dealing with a case like that?
So just looking at an investigation in particular, there's different kind of layers of that process. So if there's an assigned lead detective, he or she may have others that are assisting in the gathering of evidence, and, you know, just having conversations with people that might have some information that's pertinent to the particular investigation, looking for surveillance video, looking for anything that might corroborate what witnesses and or victims might have been able to share with the detective and their team. So there's kind of that aspect of it. And then once the investigation's complete and the reports are prepared, it, of course, would be forwarded to the district attorney's office for our review. And so initially, a case would go to an assigned deputy district attorney or myself for review. But we are regularly communicating with each other, as well as our investigators, as well as the lead detectives and officers that are involved in the underlying investigation to ensure that we have the information that we need to make a well-informed decision under the facts and the law, as well as that they have gotten all the information, you know, that they need. We have a mutual understanding of to the best as we can in terms of what's gone on. And also with larger cases, oftentimes we're working and trying to assist from the beginning of when an incident occurs. So perhaps with our DA investigators or attorneys advising along the way.
KINS News and Information Time is 8:19.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about chicken of the sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Time. It's 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Humboldt County DA Stacy Eads. Surveillance video, is that always something that is acceptable in the court? Is that something that you use for facts gathering and indications, but maybe it can't go into court? What is the function of video these days?
So, you know, I think as we all know, many people are now utilizing surveillance is a form of security for helping them to protect their homes and or businesses. So, you know, we're oftentimes on video when we might not realize that. And so in terms of, you know, doing investigations into criminal activity, surveillance video can be a very useful tool. So one of the common parts of an investigation when a crime occurs is investigators, law enforcement will canvass the area where the crime may have occurred, or perhaps where suspects are may have been in close vicinity or just looking to see if we can corroborate anything that, you know, victims or witnesses have shared with us or, you know, a potential suspect. Maybe they've asserted an alibi and that could, you know, certainly prove to be exculpatory evidence if they're on surveillance somewhere other than the crime scene. In terms of admissibility at the time of trial, there are certain elements that we have to establish prior to a court admitting the evidence during the evidentiary hearing. So we have to, you know, what we refer to as lay a foundation that the video and surveillance video is what we're, you know, saying that it is. And so that's usually a relatively easy thing to show. And, you know, that that it's accurate and is kind of a true reflection of what is recorded. And I think in, you know, as we're all far more familiar with surveillance video, it's sort of a become a bit of a norm within our daily lives. I think that there's less of a issue in terms of achieving admissibility with the court. But it has to be relevant, you know, in terms of what you're trying to prove. So that's you know, as silly as it sounds, but that's something that we have to make that link that this actually does have something to do with the crime we're trying to prove or you know, aspect that we might be, in fact, trying to disprove. And then the court's always careful about, you know, waste of time and consumption of court resources. So those are always kind of, you know, factors at play. And you don't want to alter the video. And sometimes, you know, things have to be enhanced. So you have to establish that it was necessary and how what changes were made and that they didn't distort the actual content or the relevant purpose for the evidence.
Is it seen as an invasion of privacy? If it's done in public, well, there may not be an expectation of that. But is all video, if it's pertinent, accepted in the courtroom setting, or do you have to get waivers?
Well, you know, typically it's collected with the consent of whomever is controlling the video surveillance. So, you know, when I spoke of like canvassing the neighborhood, where that's literally, you know, going door to door, knocking and seeing if you can speak with the owners or you know, of a business or a residence and inquire if they happen to have surveillance. So assuming that it's, you know, an area that's public space where an individual might not have that expectation of privacy, that's really not an issue that comes into play. Of course, there are incidences where surveillance and video is taken where people do have an expectation of privacy, and that could be the crime itself. So, you know, coming from the sex crimes background, you know, there were incidences of video being taken, you know, within bathrooms or other areas.
Aaron Andrews,
people,
you know, on a national basis, somebody through the keyhole.
Yeah, through the keyhole cracks, you know, cameras hidden within. So that's an unfortunate aspect, but kind of a different issue than I think what you were inquiring about.
Medical records, are they the same thing? I mean, there's so many laws about protecting that information. If it's pertinent to a case, are you, or is the case able to get access to that information, or are there waivers there as well?
Right. So kind of a little bit of all of the above. So certainly HIPAA can come into play in terms of our access to medical records. If we have a case that, you know, involves an assault, for example, assault and battery that you know, might result in a victim, you know, going to the hospital and receiving care and treatment, then, you know, a pretty common practice is that the investigating officer or detective would inquire of the victim whether they would consent to release of their medical records, and that certainly helps to expedite the process of obtaining those records.
Will they say yes?
Well, most people do. If they want the perpetrator to be prosecuted and
not the accused saying yes, the victim saying
right,
yes.
And that's a different course of action to get medical records that are pertaining to the accused, the defendant. But yes, there are mechanisms whereby we can subpoena those records as well, and perhaps the court will do a in-camera review of the records and make a determination whether they should be released or not.
It's 8:30.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
Radio.
I keep forgetting I'm president.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:34. We're back talking shop this morning with Stacey Eads, Humboldt County District Attorney. 1 year under your belt, huh? Is it starting to hit stride yet?
You know, it was great to hit that 1 year mark. I certainly...
Did you get a cake?
No, but that's okay. I'm not a big cake person, but... It feels great. It's been a very quick year. You know, it really passed by very quickly, and I appreciated that it would be a lot of firsts for me going through the year. Although, you know, I'd been a deputy district attorney and then as assistant district attorney, and so even having all of those years under my belt, I appreciated from the get-go that being the district attorney is it's different, and it's just to have that different level of responsibility and being responsible, you know, to a degree for the safety and welfare of the community as a whole, and also all of the employees within the office and ensuring that they have the best workplace possible so that they can continue with their excellent service to the community.
Are you surprised how much of the time is not attorneying, but is department heading, if those phrases exist?
I don't know that I'm surprised, because I feel like I was pretty fairly warned.
Maggie wrote things out in big letters, huh?
Right. So I was lucky to have the opportunity to go to, you know, statewide district attorney conferences and confer, you know, with other assistant district attorneys, and so I appreciated that, you know, dealing with kind of the administrative aspect and the personnel aspect would be a large chunk of the time that I commit to the job. And you know, but those are important aspects. If those things don't happen, then the legal part and the attorneying, I think, as you said, is not going to happen, and it's not going to be effective. And so sometimes it can be difficult to sort of pull myself away from an individual case to address an issue that impacts the big picture. So, but those are important tasks to undertake.
So the knock on the door isn't always something you look forward to. Got a minute?
okay. I leave my door open for the most part, so I probably was giving you a blank stare for what the knock
on the door
was.
Jam then, okay.
But I do appreciate that, you know, most folks, you know, they'll give me a minute to finish a sentence for an email, but learning also the importance of hitting send on an email, you know, because I will have people come in with questions or updates, and And that's a big part of my job as well, is to help with that guidance as well as to know what's happening and how we're serving the community. So I need those folks to come in, and I welcome that.
Or not hit send.
It's just it's on me to remember to hit send and and finish whatever it was that I was working on when someone comes in to give me an update or ask a question.
Miss spending more time in the courtroom?
I do miss the courtroom. Yes.
Why?
I think that I really don't know the answer to that question. But especially, when I reflect back, and originally when I went into law school, I did not intend to be a litigator. And I certainly focused on areas of law that would typically be more transactional in nature. So I did a lot of environmental law, resource, land use, as well as international law, and having kind of the science background prior to going into law school, I did not see myself as a litigator in court every day, but it certainly was something that I learned to love. And it's challenging. It's always changing. There's sort of a decorum to it. There's a degree of professionalism. And it's a matter of, when you're there as a prosecutor, you're there to do what's right. And what could be more motivating and, I guess, lack of a better word, fun, rewarding, to do kind of the right thing and to try to help someone and try to get a sense of justice, with the system that we have to work with.
But there's the stresses associated with that, too. I would suspect that while there was relief initially, that having a win-lose is something that is tough when you become a mentor rather than a doer.
Well, it's interesting, just that premise of like kind of the win-lose. Certainly things can happen in the courtroom that feel like nothing other than a loss, or vice versa. Things can happen that's like, that's an absolute win. But in terms of, looking at jury trials, for example, I tried to frame it as, so long as I am selecting the best jury that I can, who will be fair and impartial and hear the evidence, and so long as I've facilitated a presentation of that evidence so the jurors know what they need to know to make the decisions, and so long as I present the law the best I can and apply the arguments and tie those facts into the law, the decision in terms of, their verdict is theirs, So I would, as a trial lawyer,
best effort,
I tried to ensure that I did my role and would pass that on. And I think just, you were asking earlier about kind of the history of the offices and the climate within the Humboldt County District Attorney's Office, from my perspective, was never one where everyone was trying to tally up the convictions and how many people, have you convicted and, how many years in prison or those. That was never like kind of the environment. And I'm really grateful for that, because I think if that had been the case, I probably would not have continued as a prosecutor, because to me, that's not justice in and of itself. So I think a fair, well-informed decision, and at some point, there are other individuals that are part of the process. And so as long as everyone's doing their job and they're doing it well and making the best decisions that they can, I see that as a win. But yes, if you have an individual who's, acquitted and you believe all the evidence certainly shows that they committed the offense and they're not held accountable for that, that hits hard as a loss. I mean, don't misunderstand me, but so.
So it sounds like best effort is kind of the reference point.
Yeah, just keeping your perspective and, what really is our role. And as, the district attorney, everyone within the office, we represent the whole community. And so part of our role is to ensure that everyone's, you know, rights are well protected. And so it's not just about, you know, convicting people. And I just suppose I've heard, you know, of other offices, you know, in the past, perhaps that, you know, that was more the accomplishment. And, you know, how many people have you convicted?
And, kind of like pelts on
and,
the wall.
And it's like, at what cost, you know? And so, and I think that's really something that the legislators and society and the community is asking us to make sure we take a close look at. It's not at all any cost, you know, to obtain a conviction.
Yeah, well, outside you hear conviction rates. Okay. But not in reference to anything other than just how many were convicted. I can remember Terry Farmer had said, you know, we should lose 20%. Because that means that we're giving full effort. If it was 100%, then there's some bad guys that are going free, or we're not trying things that really do need to be adjudicated just to wrap things up. Obviously, that thing is stuck for a couple of years.
Right. And in those cases, you know, in particular, if you're looking at conviction rates for cases that go to trial, the cases that go to trial really should be those cases that there are questions or different interpretations of how the facts come into play with the underlying law. And so if that was 100%, that would be telling of perhaps you're not taking those cases that do need to be tried.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:44.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft Salad Dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer. Your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:49. We're back talking shop this morning with Stacey Eads, Humboldt County District Attorney. How, if you don't use win-loss ratios, and not suggesting that that ought to be, how do you know if somebody's doing the job?
Well, you know, there's certainly, you know, folks that are willing and to give feedback. So, you know, community feedback can be very helpful in terms of, you know, the interactions that the public might have had with staff members, colleagues. But I think more than anything is just ensuring to have as much interaction as I can with each member of the staff and, you know, and this is something that I wish I had more time to do but just to have regular check-ins. So, you know, something that I certainly do is we do have our weekly attorneys meetings. And then within the office, there are, you know, meetings and check-ins with each of the different, you know, units and divisions within the office. And then also I meet with my, leadership team on a weekly basis. So that's something, you know, that we started when I began last year as the district attorney, so that I can hopefully, you know, be as informed as everything, you know, as possible regarding what's taking place in the office. And it's like anything else. Sometimes it's you hear more about the negative than the good. And so I think that's an important thing to keep into perspective and trying to reinforce, you know, those good habits and those good work ethics and, you know, communicate as much as I can to the staff that they're doing a really good job, which is very much how I see it.
A feedback loop of sorts.
Feedback, yeah.
Formal or informal?
So a lot of it is probably informal. And I, you know, try to check in. There are, depending on the actual job, there are some formalities, you know, in terms of, you know, performance reviews and such. But more than anything, just ensuring that we check in. And like in for the attorneys, you know, it depends on their caseload. So, you know, some cases, you know, where you're working very closely with victims, that's a different caseload than a caseload where you're perhaps prosecuting narcotics offenses, where most of your witnesses are going to be law enforcement professionals. So that is a different, it requires a different approach from the attorneys and advocate and investigators' parts in terms of, and so the caseload might look a little bit differently, as well as, you know, conviction rates are going to look a little differently with those two different types of caseloads.
When an attorney is assigned a case, is their personality part of the determination of who you choose for what case?
Well, you know, a lot of folks, when they come into the office initially, you know, as a deputy district attorney, they might not necessarily, you know, have a sense of this is the type of case that I want to be assigned to, or this is what I want to prosecute. And so a lot of folks will come in with, which I'm grateful for, sort of the perspective of I'll do any cases. And then as they sort of evolve as a deputy district attorney, they might learn more about themselves and kind of where their strengths and weaknesses lie. And so we certainly try to take advantage of those strengths that individuals just might inherently have and work on developing skills as folks, you know, gain more years of experience as deputy district attorneys.
Having fun?
It's very rewarding, so yes.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
See everybody tomorrow.